Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of We Got This podcast. Strong and healthy company culture doesn't happen overnight. It requires time, care, and attention to show up every day and build it little by little. And I know, I'm stating the obvious here, but am I really? Judging by what I see day to day, the expectation seems to be to do a couple of workshops, allow people to work from home from time to time, throw in some free coffee in the office and maybe some pizzas and beers, and you're good to go. You're golden. Well, sorry to break it to you, that's not culture. It's an element of it, but there is much, much more to it. It's about figuring out what purpose and values drive the organization, how strategic priorities connect with your desired culture. What behaviors do you want to see more of? And most of all, what behaviors do you want to see less of? How leaders embody the values and the behaviors they and you wish to see in your teams and empower employees to take ownership of their work and contribute to the company's success. It's not an easy process, that's for sure, but it's a rewarding one, a very rewarding one. That's why it's great to see when companies go on this journey. And as it happens, today I'm joined by Alexis McAvoy, the Chief People Officer at Chapter, who over the past few months has been creating a culture guide to help codify Chapter's culture and how they work together. We Got This showcases individuals and organizations that create people-focused workplace cultures to help it become the norm rather than the exception. It's something that will require a mindset shift and probably not something that any of us can do alone. But together, we got this. Alexis, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Great to have you. I know I've put you on the spot, and I hope you had a little bit of time to think about it. And speaking of, obviously, of the icebreaker question, and that is, when you were little, who did you want to be when you grew up?
I think I wanted to be Julia Child. I've always, from a far too young age, watched cooking shows and have just fallen in love with the baking, the braising, the roasting, the prepping. I think it's just always been something I've really loved. And so it's probably like the first foray I had into that space.
Oh, okay. But is it more that cooking element or being, I'm guessing Julia Child was a kind of a bit of TV celebrity when it came to that, right? Or
I don't think it was a celebrity. I think there's probably two things. I think I've always been a little bit of a tinkerer. And so trying to test different things you can do and, you know, which ingredient in the bundt cake is going to help it taste the best. But I think the other was, I, from a young age, have liked to show people care through food. They're trying to take care of them. And so I remember being like 7 and 8 baking cakes with my mother in the kitchen. And like that act of being together was just so wonderful. And so I think there's probably a little bit of both there.
I recently was asked by a friend whether I can recommend any shows on Netflix. And my go-to every single time when anybody asks me for a recommendation is actually a documentary about food. It's a 4-episode documentary by Michael Pollan called Cooked. I don't know whether you had a chance to see it. I've seen it 6-7 times, maybe more. And the kind of disclaimer I always give to people, if you watch the episode about bread, I can guarantee you will not want to have any other bread than handmade sourdough, because every single person I've recommended it to, they said, well, thanks, like, I can't do it.
I have seen the episode. I have been to one of the bakeries.
Have you? Are you lucky?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't make my own sourdough, but maybe one day in retirement, that will be my foray.
A few years ago, which I think might be even before I watched Cooked, I did have a year or so when I was making my sourdough, but it's a lot of path, I have to say. It was worth it, but it does take a lot of effort. And yes, I'm talking before COVID. I don't know about the rest of the world. In Poland, especially, baking bread at home became a thing to the point that it was actually very difficult to get flour delivered. But I'm lucky enough, and I genuinely, it's one of the reasons I haven't moved apartments yet, is I've got a tiny micro bakery on the other side of the road, and they've got the best sourdough.
You can never leave.
I've told them that. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm secretly trying to get them to open another bakery in the place where I'm thinking of moving. Just so I've got
very smart up and coming space. lots of people around, right?
So. Yeah. And listen, I can show you a picture of queues that they've got on the Saturday morning. Before, I think they open at 8:30. You have to get there about 20 minutes before, and there are already about 20 people in front of you.
No, I'm familiar, especially in New York City. They have like very similar bakery patterns.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think why I've mentioned cooked. I know the connection about the connection to people that you mentioned. And it does actually cooked does touch upon that element of how there's no, I think he says, what greater expression of care and attention and love is there than preparing a meal for people that you care about and that you love? And that really strikes me.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. We, you know, obviously it was just Thanksgiving a little bit ago here in the States, and we did not host Thanksgiving, but had my family over the night before and cooking for everybody and playing games and having wine. You know, it's just such a wonderful feeling. And so, yeah, just something that I try to help bring to people in my life.
Fantastic. And again, in a way, you partially answered what I always wonder is how cool what you wanted to be when you grew up, when you were little. How does that connect to the work that you do now? And there is, I've already sensed the pattern. I've asked this question to nearly 60 guests, that there is that connection between who wanted to be, and there is an element of care, looking after people, helping people, some sort of service towards people or society that we had when we were little, to what we do now. So there's definitely that connection for you as well, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Although it is sort of funny, my father is in HR. And so I never thought I would go into the space. And in fact, I worked for almost 10 years, not in HR, just at startups playing different roles. And it was at some agency I was at, and they asked me to move into the HR space there. And I said no, because my dad did it. I didn't want to, you know, follow in his footsteps. I wanted to carve my own path. But eventually I realized it was the way that I could actually affect the people I really cared about in a much more meaningful way, more than budgets or how we produce work or how we engage with clients. So yeah, it sort of took me a while to really come around and accept it, I guess.
You know, when you've got lawyers, doctors in the family, there's always that kind of pressure to go into that same profession. Did you experience that same thing in your family to go into HR?
None. No, thankfully. It was never a topic of conversation, but I think my dad worked in very corporate HR in the 90s, and he wasn't home for dinner a lot. He was wearing a suit every day, and obviously like a very casual person. Just like wasn't the version of it I knew through him wasn't what I thought I wanted for myself. And I didn't know another version of it could exist. So thankfully, no pressure. But it is funny because now my sister is also in HR. So we're a real family somehow. I don't know how it happened.
See, I've never heard of that. Everybody working in HR in the family. But yeah, there you go.
We just give each other advice left and right, you know.
Let's get onto the topic of why are we here. Before we launch into it, maybe one thing that I'm actually very curious about, because as I was preparing, looking for my notes, I don't think we've actually talked about this. But you've started working on the culture guide. There's certain elements that you've really focused on around values and things like that. We'll go into that. Why, in the first place, did you decide to do that? Where did that kind of motivation, that decision come from? Was it from you? Was it from the board, C-level people within the organization?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's probably two sides. Interestingly, when I was interviewing to join Chapter, everyone had so many wonderful things to say about it, but it was also buttressed with, but we don't really have a culture. And so it was brought up proactively by almost every person that I met with through the interview process. So, okay, the organization has a want and a need here. The other side of it is, you know, I probably spent maybe close to four months, just spending time in the organization, seeing how people work, seeing how people make decisions, and trying to prioritize what are the different things that the company really needs. And so it became clear, obviously, from those conversations, helping to establish what that culture is was important. It's not to say that they didn't have values, they hadn't written things down, but how to take values and culture from something on a piece of paper and actually bring it into the organization was what was lacking in my view. And I sort of described to someone the other day that I almost sort of felt like an anthropologist for a few months, just sitting in rooms, watching people discuss things, how they make decisions, how we think about prioritization, how we plan, what's our strategy. And it was sort of through that more in-depth process of observation that it helped me to understand when people said we don't really have a culture, what they really meant was, how do we make decisions every day? What roots those decisions? How do we work together and collaborate? And how do we organize and help ourselves understand the ways that we should be working together and what great looks like in terms of what a chapterian is that can thrive and succeed and the types of people we want at our company that are existential in our view to someone being able to do the great work that we want them to do.
I think I should say this up front, just in case anyone's wondering about hidden is the advertisement. We did not work together. Alexis and I, we did not work together. Alexis had done all of this on her own within the organization. So in case you're wondering that, you don't have to wonder any longer.
You did pick your brain a bit.
You did pick my brain a bit. That's how we actually connected, which is great. But then you went off on your merry way on your own. And it's fantastic to see that after a few months, we managed to connect. And what I really like is kind of the alignment of the questions of what you just mentioned. You know, how do we make decisions? And things around that you were just kind of observing. The anthropology analogy that you used, very familiar to me. I often feel that way. And I've heard it mentioned a few times. Was it something that just kind of came from you as is, oh, this is what I want to do as an observation, this is what we need? Or was there a steer from, let's say, like from the CEO, for example?
I think the CEO, his name's Kobe, is wonderful, was a very strong partner here. He was very keen on ensuring it wasn't just an updated list of values written in a document. And we did a lot of back and forth on both what do we believe in, what do we see in the day-to-day, but also what do we see other companies doing in terms of how they communicate their values, their culture, how they want to operate as a company. And so we did a lot of research together, really talking about what we liked in other companies' approaches, what we didn't like, to help us ultimately land on what the culture guide for a chapter was. So he's been a great partner.
Oh, that's great. The reason I'm asking that is I'm leading somewhere with this, and that is that more and more I'm observing, and I think I've always seen it. I just never, for some reason, put two and two together. Is that you've got HR, broadly speaking, who look after obviously the people. They speak a very human language. Sometimes probably can be described as a little bit maybe too soft, maybe too fluffy. And then you've got other C-levels, the CEOs, the COOs, the board maybe. And they obviously have strategic priorities, business priorities, and things that they build. And what occurred to me is how separated these two camps are in many organizations, right? You've got the CEO and the board thinking of the business strategy, and then go to HR, do us a culture. We need a culture to get this to. It doesn't work that way, right? Yes, two different languages that are spoken here. Human language and a slightly more to the point, more direct, a little bit harder language. Let's call it maybe even the language of revenue and profit and money on the CEO and the board side. But they do have to go hand in hand. It's the HR has to sit at that table of, okay, this is the strategy they order in it. Great. This is what we need to do from a culture and human point of view, right? And then figure out how to adjust both. Because it's not that, okay, this is the strategic priority and let's adjust the culture that actually, no, you can adjust the culture and how you approach it, but then the strategic priorities have to be also driven or informed, maybe not driven, but informed very much by the culture that you've got or the desired culture and so on and so forth. And that's why I was so keen whether your CEO was on board, because they ultimately set the tone for all of this.
Yeah, I'm very appreciative. I've worked at many different places with many different CEOs, and I've yet to work with a partner as strong as Kobe, who's my current CEO at Chapter, who understands that culture and clear, strong ways of operating enables the business. And I think many CEOs, to your point, divorce those two, see the other as a nice to have. Sure, let's spend some time there, but they don't connect it in the same ways to revenue. Or if they do, it's purely, especially in this market right now, in the vein of excellence and performance and driving results. And that is, of course, for many companies, a key value or a key operating principle. But if everything else is separated from how people think about delivering results or what excellence looks like and what that means, it actually doesn't connect in a meaningful way.
Yes, yes. It's a tricky one. It's something that I'm working with now of how we can bridge this gap, because I very often work with people like yourself and get approached by people like yourself. So like, I've got this culture that I've dreamed up. I want to build. Can you help? Of course. First question, is your CEO, is the board on board with this? Have they co-create? Are they open to co-creating this or signing this off?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't just mean from a point of view, yeah, let's do it. It's like, as you described, as you were with Kobe, are they, you know, ready to co-create this? Because for me, culture, it's top-down and bottom-up, however you want to go, both directions, right? From individual contributors, from the ground, from the troops, to the board level, and the other way around. But the first step always has to be taken by the very top. They need to start and point in direction, and then everybody, and it goes from there. And then it's a collective effort. So it's great to hear that you were able to create that with Kobe and within chapter.
I wrote this LinkedIn post a few months ago from some learnings from various past CEOs, which was, don't mistake curiosity for willingness to change. Mm-hmm. And what was so fascinating, I wrote that about, you know, an amalgamation of experiences I've had. But what was so interesting is that I had people from every single company I've ever worked with reach out to me like, that's about our CEO. That's about our CEO. That, you know, they can say on paper they are willing to invest in these things, they care. But if in practice, they are not demonstrating real ways that they themselves are trying to create the type of environment and company they want to, at least they're saying on paper, it's actually more indicative than anything else of their real willingness to be part of that journey with you.
Yeah, it's a difficult one. You know, sometimes I'm in moments of doubt, I'll really blame capitalism because we're so revenue driven. But then obviously, if it wasn't for capitalism, probably we wouldn't be in a place where we are now. So it's not that not wanting to generate profit and revenue. And this is something that I'm also toying with because we talk about money versus people. It's one or the other. It's not that binary. It's not an either or. It's both and. It's just figuring out. It's not a problem. I love the concept of polarities. You need, they are opposite things, yes, but they need each other. You don't have money without people, and you don't have people without money within the organization, right? So it's figuring out how to manage it. I don't want to say even balance it, because I think that would be even worse, but definitely how to manage this polarity that you need these two things.
It's very interesting. You know, obviously I have a pretty unique experience of chapter. So, you know, when companies talk about being mission-oriented or mission-driven, you know, we're dedicated to helping folks navigate Medicare and retirement. And our very first value is put members first. And so what that means is if members come to us and they're on the best Medicare plan, we don't sell them on a plan they don't need. So we lose revenue opportunities by doing what is right for the people that we're trying to help. And I don't know that I've been at a company that is willing to make those difficult trade-offs every single day. But I think it very much extends back to the people at the company. If that's how you think about society and the change you're trying to make, it's similar to the way we're thinking about our company and what we prioritize and how we engage with our people. It can't all be about the bottom line. It has to be about what we're trying to do in the world. What are strategies to do that and how we help our people move in that direction?
I've just realized it might be worth in a couple of sentences to explain what Chapter actually does. Would you mind sharing that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So as I mentioned, we are trying to help people navigate Medicare, which is an incredibly complex and complicated health system in America, and ultimately retirement more broadly. We're trying to do so, obviously, from that mission orientation where there is no other company that is independent, that has access to all of the plans across all of the carriers. And so, you know, if you call up an insurance agent, they'll sell you one they have access to. Or maybe they're incentivized by insurance carrier to actually sell you on a certain type of plan. So being independent and all those sorts of things is incredibly important. On the other half of our business is how do we engage older Americans through technology? So how do we actually build real products that serve real needs before we think about how to monetize and create a bunch of revenue? If you can, I was just listening to a podcast with the Airbnb CEO, and he was saying, if you can build something amazing that 100 people will tell everyone they know about, that is so much more meaningful than trying to build something that will please 1,000 people out the gate. How do you find real value through technology, through product, and then figure out how to scale from there? And so we're trying to transform the retirement experience through technology.
Wow, that's brilliant. I knew a little bit about it, but now that you kind of explain it in more detail, it sounds a little fun. The wanting 100 people to be, you know, raving about you, that reminded me of Seth Godin. I don't know whether you've heard of the guy. Absolutely love him as well. I don't know the number. I want to say 500 that he quotes, that you need 500 hardcore fans
and you're good as an organization, no matter what you do, whether it's an organization or whether it's you've got a band, an amateur band that just plays gigs on Saturdays and weekends in general, and you need 500 people to buy your CDs whenever you release them, and you're good to go. So it's there's definitely truth to that. Let's come back. So to you being an anthropologist, you've been observing, you've been looking at things. We know why you were doing that, but can you tell us a little bit more how you actually went about creating that culture guide? Because if I remember correctly, you decided to focus on values and purpose. That was the main kind of priority. Were there any other culture building blocks that you were looking at?
Values, purpose, how we organize and plan. Which we talk about all the time. We talk about OKRs, we give updates to the whole company, but putting down on a piece of paper, here's why we think about planning and why it's important that we approach it this way. So I think the biggest effort was really around the values piece, right? So we had maybe 6 values written down in quite complex language on a document that, you know, we send to new folks and they have a chat with the CEO, but again, was not part of the ingrained day-to-day. Through that observational practice over the few months, I put pen to paper and went back and forth with the CEO on what sort of we consider as our top. I think we even started with, let's say, 8, 9, 10 values. And we whittled them down to what are the most impactful set of values that we believe drive our business, how we make decisions, and the types of people we want at the company every single day. I then led focus groups across the company and gathered feedback, good, bad, ugly, on the different values we drafted up. And I probably went through 4 or 5 different revisions, trying to iterate, test, get different people's opinions, reactions, testing them actually through values alignment interviews that I would do for folks who are hiring. So if we say these are the values, let's actually test for it in interviews and see if it's actually working. And then I think importantly, the extension beyond just this is the value, here's how we describe it, but we quite literally created a list of do's and don'ts. So for example, when we talk about put members first, we have a list of things that put members first means in practice and things that would be against that. So for example, selling an insurance plan to somebody that they don't need and they're on a great plan, that is a don't. And so even just through writing something and through talking to the company, being able to put it a little bit more into practice, take it away from the heady, elevated language, the 10,000th of you, bring it into the day-to-day and say, here's a great set of examples to help you to understand what this means in practice. So that was sort of the process by which we got to the written culture guide, which we shared at an all hands. We walked people through. We make it part of onboarding. So yeah, it was a long journey. But I think maybe interestingly, the work wasn't done there. And I think this is what, you know, you talk about a lot, like, which is just doing the work, putting it down doesn't mean it is part of the company, right? It certainly helped us to orient and make sure we're focused on the right things. But what I realized is that we still needed much more clarity on how some of these values extend into how we operate. So how do we actually work in the day-to-day? How do we make decisions? Having more shared language around the different roles and responsibilities across the company. And so we actually sort of have like a tandem set of artifacts now, which is this culture guide, lots of information about the values, how we organize, how we plan, the do's and the don'ts. And then we have how we work, which is how we resource, how we make decisions. What are the roles in that? What if you have a need that you believe rises beyond the resourcing of your team? Where do you take those things? And so just trying to sort of smooth out how the values help us operate in the day-to-day a little bit more.
Oh, please don't stop talking. It's music to my ears because I doubt myself. I often see somewhat blank expressions on people's faces when I talk about things like that. And the thing is, obviously, I'm not within an organization. I'm not a chief people officer. I'm not a chief culture officer. By the way, chief culture officers should be more prevalent and there should be more of them within organizations, dedicated people for culture. And that's kind of the argument, counter argument for what I say. It's like, well, you don't work in an organization, but there are countless examples of organizations that actually do what I say. And you just prove that, and that's why I said it's music to my ears, because so many organizations do have even this work that you do, the discovery part, and it's great, it's really great to see. And sometimes
simply they don't know what to do with that next. And I appreciate that is difficult. But some, they just don't want to know. They assume that this is, I've done this, job done.
No.
You've actually, although it doesn't seem that way, you've probably done one of the easiest parts, bring it to life. That's the tricky bit. That's the, maybe not tricky, let me rephrase, not tricky, the somewhat more uncomfortable one, because you have to confront with certain things of how you were doing things up until now. Obviously, you're going to have to put an effort in changing the energy of doing things differently. Will there's more energy that's going to be required? And, you know, there are pressures, there are things, there are times in life and within the year that you simply not more want to be doing doing certain things. And I think that's what stops people from going further. And that's the difficulty that I see, is that we've done the first bit. We feel good about ourselves, which is great. Go roll with that momentum. Don't stop.
Right. Yeah. It makes me think a lot about your comment about the CEO partnership. So one of our values is ownership, not ego. And you know, what we're really trying to espouse is end-to-end ownership, autonomy over the space and the things that you work on. But what's so interesting is when you think about a culture where you have lots of owners, lots of opinions, lots of people who believe that they're the expert in lots of different places, when you have two people, let's say of equal level, who have completely differing opinions on how to approach something, when they run into that stalemate, their natural reaction is to go to the CEO and say, CEO, can you just tiebreak for us? Tell us what you want to do. And it actually goes against the value and the culture we're trying to build. And so I give a lot of props to Kobe, who is very, you know, the very first one to recognize, I am not as close in the details as you all are to make this decision. Two, here are some things I would think about. Here are some questions to consider. Three, I want you to figure out how to find a solution together. I so appreciate that that exchange happens all the time across the company to reinforce one of our most important values, which is you are the owners. We want you to figure out how to work through this together. And we can help, but ultimately, you're the owner. We want that to sit on your head and be your responsibility, because if the CEO has to make every decision, we're just the company of the CEO. We are not chapter. We are not chapterians. We are not all together trying to affect change.
And you beautifully illustrate the point I made earlier as well, is when you as chief people officer want to do this culture and you've got this plan and you're running with it and you see your sort of only signs off on that together with the board. So you go ahead, you do that, versus actually being fully immersed in it, co-creating it and doing what you've described what Kobe does. If they are only just kind of, you're good, go and run. When somebody comes to them to tie break, they don't do what you described Kobe does, is they do their default CEO attitude of actually tie breaking things. So whether they want it or not, and I'm implying zero malice here, on a subconscious level, many CEOs who are not bought in, who haven't co-created the culture, will, on an even a subconscious level, will undermine it, what's being created.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people will, right? If they don't feel like the culture is representative of the day-to-day, or it feels like too much of a stretch, right? Because I think a lot of values that the companies create are either some portion of them are reflective of the day-to-day today, and some portion are probably stretch values. This is the direction we want to go and we want to be this type of company. And particularly, I find where that stretch exists, it is much harder to get people to try to adapt and align to that new way. And so we have to use the language of the culture of the values guide with people every single day. Hey, so-and-so, I know you're working on XYZ. I really want you to think about this like an owner. Think about it from end to end. I want you to think about the implications of the work, how it connects to other teams, how it affects the other things you're working on. You have to tie that language in every single day to help people start to move in that direction if they aren't already there.
How do you create that language? Do you get people to create it themselves? But it's all kind of at which stage? Because it's easy to go down the route of going, this is the language that we want. But again, there's a fine line, there's a fine balance between having to be actually prescriptive, descriptive and directional, but not taking it too far so that people are not feeling that it's not theirs. And I often use the Inception example from the movie Inception, Learn How DiCaprio Dreams, right? Dream have to be really, really deep into a person's subconscious and mind for it to say, if not, they will reject it. And similar here. How do you find that line? How do you do that?
I think there's two really important things, that sort of anthropology phase, that listening phase, that gave me the opportunity to understand the language people were using every single day. And so when we actually created that guide and put that shared language down in a document, when we plan to share it with the whole company, it is not just my language. It is not just the CEO's language. It is how the company speaks about these things every single day. And so it's about really bringing in that dynamic into the guide every single day. But I think also really importantly, which makes this so difficult, companies change. And so the work is never done, which makes it, gives me a little bit of anxiety thinking about it now. But, you know, probably in another 6 months, we're going to have to redo the whole thing to adapt to how the company is changing, how we're growing, how we're scaling. Are there different things we didn't think about at the time? So I think importantly, it also doesn't work if you're stale and you sit on it for too long and you don't reflect the reality of how the company shifts. This is when I was at Palantir, which is a much larger tech company. They're public now. I was there for 7 years. I think, gosh, the company's been around for, I don't even know, 15, 20 years now. My biggest critique at the time was that the CEO, the board, the founders, they were so removed from the day-to-day. They had no understanding of what the company actually felt like anymore. And they kept holding on to these values that they created in 2003, but it didn't carry through in the same way to everyone at the company anymore. And so that's a great point where, like, when you aren't open to change and that willingness to understand how the experience is adapted, it breaks even further, I think.
Because we were talking a lot about language, if I may point out one thing about the language that you use that I think will actually be beneficial. I'm pretty certain you've said we will have to change everything in 6 months' time. I agree with the sentiment, but I think change and everything are not the right words. I would say...
Right, it's evolve. Not everything.
I would say it's evolve.
Iteration.
Yes, because...
Yes, you've got to build...
That's the important bit, because you've done majority of the heavy lifting to build that foundation. So now it's about tweaking. And you're right, culture is a living organism. It's created by the people that are within the organization now. And even through, based on that, once you have one person leave and one person join, that's already changing the dynamic. That person brings something new to table. Obviously, you pick that person based on what you've got and what the needs of your organization are and the needs of the people within the organization, the needs of the people that join the organization. You pick people based on that. So they will meet, but there's always an element of evolution. You want to be picking people who will bring something to evolve, to add to the culture that you've created. And that's one of the things, you know, I go through a process with clients that I can very broadly break up to three steps. Step one, do the audit, do kind of the design part of culture. So what you've got now, where you want to be, what culture you want to create. Step one, step two, bringing it to life. And step three is the one that a lot of people are surprised by, even though it's a multi-month process. The step three is actually evolving it, because by the time we actually get to deployment and bringing it to life, you already need to be tweaking as you go. And there are elements that you say, okay, what's working? Which bits are working, which are not? Which we need to be tweaking? Where did we have people join? Where did we have people leave? What type of people were there? And so on and so forth. And based on that, you make these adjustments to suit the current situation. Even if you look at external factors, the economy, okay? What's going on in the world, you have to respond to that as an organization. That will obviously, one way or another, difficult to predict, affect your culture.
Absolutely. It's constant iteration. The work is truly never done.
Exactly. Exactly. But I think that's, again, brings us back to the question that we do the initial work and then we stop. It's the similar things here. You know, we've done the initial work, we've done the bringing it to life, and we stop. No, it continues, right? Even there's one thing that you said, I think, at the beginning, that, wow, we don't really have a culture. Another misconception. Good or bad, you always have culture.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think particularly for folks in startups, in those first few years, the culture very often is a manifestation of how the co-founders are. And so that there are positives and negatives potentially to that. And so how do you think about moving it beyond just a founder-led culture?
I'm always curious, and whenever I get the opportunity, I jump at it to work with startups, usually the ones that obviously have been working and for a number of years, and they've got, you know, several years of rounds of funding maybe. I've noticed that it's around usually Series A, Series B, where they've got enough runway
to start actually investing into culture a little bit more, just paying a little bit more attention to it and being what I call intentional about it. And the reason I do that is because in the organizations I often work with, they are more mature in number of people or revenue or number of years that they've been operating, that we are undoing certain things that they didn't kind of address when they were younger, when they were smaller. And that's why I'm drawn to startups, because there's a lot of research that points to something called the cultural chasm that appears roughly within the first 3 years of an organization's life, based on what you said. Culture was founder-led. You could shout and talk to the founder because he or she was sitting the desk next to you. But after a year or two, you've added more people, you've added a layer of management, and things different. And the cultural chasm comes from the people who have been with the organization from the off to now 3 years down the line, for example, when they feel that it's just not how it was. And the disillusionment, disheartenment comes in, and it all comes in because we just kind of left it and we're hoping for the best. What we had as a culture, it will continue and it will be fine.
Yeah, very apt. I joined Chapter just 3 years after they started. So
there you go.
Timeline is spot on. There you go.
I'll dig up the research, because I remember it was from an article, and it's fresh in my mind because a couple of weeks ago, I actually did a session for a startup program with about 160 founders, very early days. So they're just building up their company, their MVPs, their ideas. And they're part of a kind of multi-month, multi-week program and of sessions. And I had one session on culture just to tell them, listen, I know where you are, and I'm not telling you that the culture is everything at this moment in time, because I know you've got far greater priorities. Just to give you an idea of what we talk about when it comes to culture and the few things that you can do now that will genuinely help you and save you a lot of headaches further down the line when you actually have a company. Because I was using the analogy of, you know, 3, 5, 10 years down the line, that's the headaches that you want to avoid. But you need to put in the effort to actually build a company, because you won't have a company in 3, 5, 10 years down the line. That's the thing. So it's about that balance. So 5 to 10% of your time and energy resources now will save you a lot of further down the line.
One of the things I've seen at a lot of different, to be clear, my whole background has been in startups. So it's where I've spent my life and it's a space I love. I have worked with a lot of leaders who talk a lot about, particularly in the earlier stages of a company, needing less diversity of thought, because you have to move so quickly. And actually, diversity of thought can slow you down, and iteration and evolution are stifled. I'm interested for your experience from what you've seen with different companies, how you think about the balance there, where obviously you want diversity of people, diversity of thought leads to better ideas, more success. It's been proven. But in those early days of a startup, it is very often sometimes frowned upon because it feels slow.
In general, I think that there's a misconception when it comes to diversity of thought and let's just use kind of decision making from a leadership point of view, of that we should, first of all, that we should be making decisions by consensus or majority or whatever, you know, how we make decisions. One, there's not enough clarity on that. But the main misconception I see is that there's only one model, one way. So we always make decisions by consensus. So, you know, we'll sit down, we'll talk through an issue, we'll figure it out, and then agree the best kind of course of action as a group. Okay? I'm in favor of that. However, not always, and this is where the misconception comes in, and I use the analogies. Listen, when things are on fire, you're not going to be sitting around holding hands and trying to figure out what the hell you need to do, or what you're going to do, or maybe we're going to do this, maybe we're going to do that. No, as a leader, you change your style. You go into, you there, grab the sandbox, you there, grab the fire extinguisher, you call the fire squad. You completely different thing. Decision-making goes out the window. And I think with startups is very, very similar, because there are so many moving parts that there is time and place to also talk about a few things and utilize the, maybe not necessarily diversity of thought, but just the creative brain power of multiple people, but not in the way that if we all don't agree, we're not doing this. Now, I, as founder, I want to utilize, you know, my blind spots get the knowledge from you to minimize my blind spot, and then I'll make the decision, for example. Because the same as with team development dynamics is when a team comes together, the expectation is that there's a manager and all the people joining the team, they are looking up to the leader for direction. That's what's supposed to happen.
And as the team progresses, they mature, gain autonomy. The leader becomes more of a kind of central point, and to the point that you actually, ideally, you want the leader to be completely outside of the team and the team to be entirely independent. That's the ideal.
Right.
And I think with startups,
great leaders replace themselves.
Exactly. They change their role because they become then the person that the team comes to when they hit some sort of wall or glass ceiling that they cannot on their own, from where they sit, what their capabilities are and the connections they've got within the organization, that they cannot overcome themselves. Then they come to the leader and say, do you mind helping us out? Because we need X, Y, and Z from this, that, and that person.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I think you're right. In those moments of crisis, you have to be able to act quickly. And I almost call it like lizard brain. Your normal thinking brain switches off. You say, you go do this, you go that, I'm going to solve this. And I also agree with you to the point of decision-making, that being really clear about who has what role in that relationship is incredibly important. And I completely agree. Decision-making by consensus in most situations is, it could be the death of a company, because you just turn over things over and over again without being able to actually just move forward.
The challenge I find with decisions by consensus is the fact that you can never be 100% sure why somebody's opposing something, whether there is a genuine thing about that they just disagree with that and they've got, you know, reasons to back that, or whether there are political things at play that you might not be aware of. And I think that's my biggest problem with making decisions by consensus, because that adds another very severe layer of complexity that you're not going to be able to get over, especially if you've got a large organization. So I mostly work with small to medium organizations, simply because of my preference for the decision chain being as short as possible. Mm-hmm, I've worked on a large scale cultural transformations with organizations of 2,000-3,000 plus employees. Decision chain is insane and takes forever and takes an army of people to be able to change that culture from an external point of view, not to mention the amount of change that and work that needs to be put in within the organization by every single individual that works within that team, within that company.
I liken that experience when I was in it to feeling like you're sitting at the helm of the Titanic and trying to steer it away from an iceberg. You're just so slow and it can only turn so much. And it's tough in that environment.
I love the analogy. I've got one final question that's sitting on my mind, because you've been working on this for quite a while. It's been a few months. It's been live, I guess, for some time, and obviously live in inverted commas. What have you seen? What impacts, what changes have you seen within the organization as a result of that, in terms of, I'll let you take the pay, but in terms of how people work, how the business performs, how people feel, you name it.
I think the first thing for us is putting first and foremost that we put members first, and both hearing from people that they feel that in practice and appreciate that that is the first thing we talk about is incredibly validating, because that is really the ethos of the company that we're trying to build. I think second is seeing the ways that we've helped unlock positive feedback across the organization rooted in values has been really amazing. And seeing it not just within teams, but across teams, like giving people the language to talk about how someone contributed or added value or impacted them has been fantastic. Just letting people learn how to flex that muscle a little bit more. I think on the third page, we're seeing, obviously, as I mentioned, the use of the language around the values and how we work put in practice much more. And I'll be honest, I've probably made, 15 to 20 changes to either the culture guide or the how we work guide since we rolled it out, just through conversations, seeing how things are even starting to evolve today. And so again, it's just that constant openness and that iteration. We saw great results from our pulse scores between April and September. Massive improvements across every single category, essentially, which was fantastic. And I told the company not to expect that level of jumps every single time. It's just not possible. But I think it's also shown us that there are still places where we need to invest in helping people to understand in more ambiguous situations what the right way is to operate, or what the chapter way to operate would be, and how we help people get feedback in that environment, work cross-functionally in that environment. We're an incredibly cross-functional organization. Decisions in one part of the company will affect 15 other parts. And so how we help people to understand those implications, how we help them to contextualize and make sure we're sharing enough transparently about what we're focused on, what we're trying to solve for, and how that decision 17 steps later does affect the bigger picture. Really trying to keep it between the 10,000 foot view and the 100 foot view and help people to draw that connection point for themselves has been incredibly important. And then I think, you know, building a robust onboarding program to ensure that every person who joins the company is ingrained and bought in to the type of company we're trying to build. You know, we worked it into our interview process. So we vet every hire from a values perspective. Okay, once you're here, how do we make sure that it's really in the forefront of their mind in terms of how they operate every day?
Oh, so some really, really solid impacts and things that you've seen. And as you said, yeah, it's something that will definitely continue to evolve. And I'm glad that you did manage the expectations. Don't expect this type of jump to be like, because it's like, what happens? Like this 6 months down the line, it's like, why is this jump? Why it's not going as well as it was?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, to your point, there's evolution and that will be forward evolution and backwards evolution. And it's about how we respond and how we support and how we enable.
Have you seen, and do you think it's actually possible to link the work that you've done and the changes that you've been seeing to how the business operates, how it performs more kind of, let's call it from the language of money point of view, anything to do with revenue, not jumping obviously into actually hard figures. Now that's not what I'm after, but have you been seeing any connections in that respect?
It always makes me think about when you interview for a people role and they say, well, how do you measure success for this role? Right. And it's like, oh, if only there was one metric that you could easily definitively tie.
Why do you think I'm asking you that question? Because I'm looking for the answer myself.
Yeah, no, I want the answer too. Yeah. Or really my answer is like pretty authentic. They don't think there's a single metric, but you know, I would say that this has certainly contributed to us being able to move faster, to us being able to ensure we have the right people in the right roles. It's helped us to continue to hold up that banner of making the right decisions for our members and not the best decision that makes us the most money the fastest. And so I think there's lots of things that it could contribute to, but I would be foolish to say it would be the only contributing factor that would help us to affect that metric or that piece of data, unfortunately.
Damn. Thank you for trying. Thank you for trying. I've been searching for that. And I always ask that question to see, you know, what we can arrive. Because I agree, there's not one metric. I'm trying to quantify, because from the work that I do, I often get asked that question. And one of the things I started looking at recently is the cost of losing employees and making it, obviously it's kind of in a napkin type of calculation. Nonetheless, it's still valid. Because if you consider that, you know, a lot of reasons why people leave is cultural, let's assume 30%, which I think is an understatement anyway, but 30% of the people that leave an organization. So if an organization has 100 people, and I don't know what the turnover rate is in the US at the moment, but in Poland last year was 19 people, 19%. So 19 people out of 100 would leave. Let's assume, 30-40, let's assume 7 people, so about 36% leave the organization as a result of cultural reasons. It costs the organization a yearly salary of that person. When you do the math, it's insane.
Hiring, the time it takes away from employees to be part of the interview process, onboarding, ramp up to get them back up to the level, right? I think the other qualification on that is, and to your point that someone could leave a company and the culture changes, someone joins a company and changes, regrettable sentiment. Who are the people left that we would have fought to keep that are meaningful contributors such that we feel like they have to be at this company? That's actually the metric that is probably the most important when we think about the culture and how we're trying to affect change and ensure that great people want to come here and they want to stay.
Yes, yes. And yes, again, I'm it's on my mind, but what's next for you? Where do you go from here? What are the next steps for the end of the year? Because we're recording this, obviously, end of 2023. But for 2024, what are you going to do with this from here?
Yeah, I'm a sucker for planning and strategy and vision. And so I'm really excited to spend some time with our leadership team focused on the 2024 strategy. As I mentioned, we're building this app to engage our members digitally. And so we've been in such an interesting, V0 product development phase. I'm so excited to continue to see that work. I've personally learned so much about building product, not that I'm building it, but getting to see it from the sidelines. So I'm really excited to see that work continue to 2024. And then personally, going to a wedding in India in the spring, and I'm very excited to have just such a different experience. I have a toddler and we're leaving her at home. So it'll be our first very big trip without the kid and getting to just try something completely different. So getting out of the comfort zone a little bit will be really fun.
A little bit with that India trip. Yes. I think that's a bit of an understatement. But wow, exciting. I've never been, but I've heard great things, especially I know Indian weddings. Yeah. I've lived in the UK for many years and I know what Indian weddings are like. I've attended a couple in the UK. Whew, you're in for a treat. That's for sure. And sounds exciting on the job front as well. What can I say apart from a humongous thank you for taking the time and sharing your experience at Chapter. Every single guest has a standing invitation to come back. You as well, in a few months next year to see how all this pans out. Or maybe we get Kobe in together all on his own. Just to say, okay, can you vet these things that Alex is... that might be an interesting thing, but let's pick that up of the Alex.
Yeah,
again, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much. It was a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it.
Yes. I am not crazy. Well, at least not as crazy as some people think I might be. I'm not an idealist anymore with what I say when it comes to company culture, because organizations, as I describe them, as I'd love them to be, exist. So that is reality. It's not idealism. It exists, and Alexis and Chapter are one of the examples, one of the many examples. And I'm so delighted that I could share that with you. And I feel much better because as a workplace culture designer, I often do feel a little bit like, am I nuts? I'm questioning myself. But thanks to people like Alexis and Kobe and everybody at Chapter and in organizations similar to them, making me feel like, no, you're not. So that's my own pep talk for myself. Thank you very much for tuning in. Until next time.